Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Damage Report. I'm John Adirola. It is a big day, obviously. The impeachment inquiry continues. We'll be starting on that in just a little bit. But throughout this hour, you can expect a lot. Three different guests. In not long, Nomiki Konstas is going to be joining us on the show to talk about the launch of a new organization that's working to help working class women get elected to positions around the country. We've got Emma Vigeland of Rebel HQ is going to be joining us to break down the big news of the day, including obviously the most important news, which is Fartgate. We're going to get to the bottom of it, so to speak. And then we're going to be joined by Ramesh, you've probably seen recently on the main show. He's going to be joining us to talk about his new book. By the way, stick around for the end of the show. We're going to be giving you a little bit of information about the protests going on in Iran right now. These are protests that have already suffered a number of deaths due to violence from the regime there. So we'll be giving you some of that information to close out the show. But before we can get to all of that, and there is a lot, we're going to be starting off with the impeachment hearings. Donald Trump really wants to defend himself when it comes to impeachment. But the different ways he could do that, including testifying or even just getting involved on social media, even his like close allies don't necessarily think that's a great idea. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
I just think overall, president should just ignore this whole thing. Don't tweet during it. Don't get outraged over it. It ticks you off.
Right.
And I think that there's so much for him to do. I just think that let these guys like Doug Collins and company fight out and keep it on the straight and narrow from the Republican perspective.
You know?
So he's sort of pitching as, you know, don't get involved because like, you know, you're just going to get mad and like you've got stuff to do. When what he really means is, like 4 days ago when you tweeted during the Yovanovitch testimony, it was a disaster for you and very likely added a potential impeachable charge there on its own. And so Brian Kilmeade, Ducey and Ainsley Earhart are all pretty much in agreement. No, don't get involved, don't do the Twitter. But that's kind of a pointless thing. They can get him to do almost anything just by choosing what stories they focus on. They can actually shift the direction of the federal government. But they do have a limit to their power. And I think that that limit comes when you try to get Donald Trump to put down his phone for a little while. They can say he's got things to do, but Donald Trump doesn't care about his responsibilities as president. He's watching TV and he's tweeting. That's what he's going to be doing for the next couple of months. Each of these last 2 days of the big days of the hearing, he's said he's not going to tune in, he's too busy. And yet he's found time to retweet literally dozens of video clips in each case. So they have tried to help him there. Again, these are allies of the president, but it is going to be worthless because he can't help himself. Now, in terms of getting involved in a more direct way, actually testifying, which he implied yesterday he'd want to do, I don't buy it at all. But what if he did actually do it? Here is what Chris Wallace had to say.
I would think that would be akin to Prince Andrew testifying about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, which one British critic said was like an airplane crashing into an oil tanker, causing a tsunami that set off a nuclear explosion. It's an entertaining thing and it certainly got us all talking, but my guess is it's not going to happen. And if it did, it would be a very controversial and perhaps unwise policy by the president.
There's a metaphor for you. And yeah, look, Chris Wallace obviously is less of a fan of Donald Trump than someone like Brian Kilmeade. But he's still very much a conservative and he's been around long enough to know that it would of course be a disaster for Donald Trump if he were to testify. Him or Rudy Giuliani, those are the two worst examples. I mean, pretty much anyone you put up there is going to do some damage to the president, but nobody can do as much damage as those two. Donald Trump, like you could get him to say that he extorted Ukraine just by implying that it's strong to do so. He'd be like, well, then sign me up. I'm strong. I did that. He can't do it. And look, Donald Trump, he's a dumb person in a lot of ways. And he has very little self-awareness. He can't help himself from projecting in any number of different ways. But he does have at least a little bit of self-awareness. And he does seem to understand on some level that he can't trust himself to represent himself, which is why he didn't testify to Robert Mueller. He could have done that. He chose not to because he knew how damaging it would be. And in the same way, I would be shocked if Donald Trump chose to testify because he knows how damning it would be. He knows how much he speaks bombastically or lies or reveals things he doesn't intend to. It would be horribly damaging to his efforts to stop himself from being either impeached or eventually removed from office. And so I don't expect it to happen. But anyway, as we proceed with this impeachment, that's what the conservatives have to say about Donald Trump. And that is really something. But let's move on to today's hearings. So today, more public impeachment hearings and already some pretty big moments. We're coming into this pretty early in the morning, but Let me give you just a little short clip. And this, just in a few seconds, really summarizes the amount of damage that's being done to Donald Trump today.
In this July 25th call between the presidents of the United States and Ukraine, President Trump demanded a favor of President Zelensky to conduct investigations that both of you acknowledge were for President Trump's political interest, not the national interest. And in return for his promise of a much desired White House meeting for President Zelensky. Colonel Vindman, is that an accurate summary of the excerpts that we just looked at?
Yes.
Ms. Williams?
Yes.
So that's your two big witnesses from today saying that, yeah, Donald Trump was doing this. We know that he was doing this and he was doing it for his own personal benefit. There's no argument to be made that this was for America's interest, that somehow extorting Ukraine in this way, was beneficial to the American people. And so look, there's obviously a lot more than that. We're talking about hours and hours and hours of testimony, but that in effect sums it up. And what you really have is them laying out basically what they've said in the past, those two witnesses, but very clearly, and then Republican attempts to sort of muddy the waters and confuse people. And so Devin Nunes is a great example of that. You basically had Devin Nunes and Jim Jordan, at least early on, attempting to do this. Devin Nunes, though, ran up against one really interesting moment early on. There's a short clip, but take a look.
Mr. Vindman, you testified in your deposition that you did not know the whistleblower.
Ranking member, it's Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, please.
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, you testified in the deposition that you did not know who the whistleblower was.
So that's a great moment because look, the natural end of them trying to attack this lieutenant colonel as being unpatriotic or whatever, he's like a Purple Heart recipient and everything, was that they also just tried to strip him of his title, and I love that he asserted it. I'm not saying that you should be like unnaturally deferential to people simply because they served in the military or anything, but he is a lieutenant colonel and he's not gonna let Devin Nunes, of all people, a guy whose most notable achievement in this life is suing a fictional cow, take away his military service in that way. Now, we can't go through all of the attempts to attack Vindman. Those continued, that's gonna be a big thing. That's gonna continue throughout the day. Jim Jordan certainly got involved in that too. And at one point, Vindman had to actually read excerpts from a glowing performance review that he had received. So just bear that in mind. The smears against Vindman, those are continuing too. But there's also another thing that Nunes was trying to do. He wanted you to lose respect for Vindman, to cast some sort of shadow on his testimony. But Nunes also was advancing the only part of this whole story that the Republicans are interested in. That is the identity of the whistleblower. Here's his attempt to out the whistleblower.
As you know, the intelligence community has 17 different agencies. What agency was this individual from?
If I could interject here. We don't want to use these proceedings.
It's our time,
I know,
Mr. Chair.
But we need to protect the whistleblower.
Please stop.
I want to make sure that there's no effort to out the whistleblower through the use of these proceedings. If the witness has a good faith belief that this may reveal the identity of the whistleblower, that is not the purpose that we are here for. And I want to advise the witness accordingly.
So look, that's what Devin Nunes is trying to do. Schiff isn't going to allow that to happen. And I will say for the 100th time, who cares who the whistleblower is at this point? Devin Nunes doesn't care who the whistleblower is. He just wants to make you think that he does. And furthermore, to make you think that it's important that we find out that there's this mystery that has nothing to do with what Donald Trump actually did vis-a-vis Ukraine. There's some hidden secretive thing that you should be focusing on instead, when it doesn't matter at all at this point. We are so far past that. And so good on Schiff for actually shutting that down. But that's basically what Devin Nunes used his time for, trying to out the whistleblower and talking a lot about the Mueller report for some reason when we're talking about Ukraine right now. That's what the purpose of the hearing is. So that hearing continues today. We'll have more on it on tomorrow's show. For now though, we do have to take a break. We come back, Namika Kant's gonna be joining us in studio to talk about our new group.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, The host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Despite record numbers of women running in the last election, they are still wildly underrepresented in Congress, but perhaps not for much longer, thanks to the launch of a new group. And joining us to tell us about Matriarch, Nomi.
Hi, John.
Welcome back.
Thank you. It's so different, but so familiar.
Yeah, I had assumed that you had been in studio before. Mm-hmm. You've Skyped into the show many times, but obviously you're not from these parts.
Right.
I don't think that there could be a better topic for you to join us in studio to talk about. Tell us about the launch of this group.
So this is extremely exciting because we have, there's a group of over 36 women who have come together, progressive leaders. Some are in office, some have run for office, some have lost.
A lot of experience.
Activists, union organizers, people who know what it's like on the ground in their communities across the country. It's geographically diverse, diversity of thought, of experience. And we came together because there was a space, there was a void in the ecosystem of the Democratic side of politics in supporting working class women. We've seen a record number, as you said, of women run for office in the last few years. We had another year of the woman in 2016. But the reality is you know, just under 25% of Congress is made up of women.
That's crazy.
And like, of that, how many are progressive? Mm-hmm. And of that, how many are people of color?
Mm-hmm.
So
several.
Yeah.
But that's it.
Like, yes. Under a handful.
Yes.
But you also see the power of the squad. The squad is, you know, they're not the first progressive women to be elected, but they were elected, you know, very young, no corporate money, didn't have to go through the pipelines of Democratic power that so many have had to do or take on to win, although some did take them on. And it gave, I think, a lot of women hope that they could do it too. And so this year we see so many working class women running that are progressive across the country, but they need some help. And
helping with organizing, fundraising, those sorts of things. So this group is going to help bring all of this experience that its board has, which is, you know, like collectively hundreds of years of electoral experience.
Yeah.
and provide that to women who might be running for the first time or maybe the second time, don't necessarily have connections to some of these like establishment DNC organizations and things like that.
And you know, there's something to be said about running on a progressive agenda and dealing with the issues on a day-to-day basis that most Americans are dealing with. When you go into Congress and you've dealt with student loan debt and you've dealt with not having access to healthcare and you've dealt with the criminal justice system, you go in there with a different type of energy. You're not only representing your community in Congress, but you're bringing a voice that literally hundreds of thousands of people in your district do not have.
Yeah.
So it's more powerful. We think it's more electable when working women run on a progressive platform, but you know, it doesn't serve in the establishment's interests to support women who come from a working class background, who fight for economic justice, and who, of course, don't take corporate money. So
Is that a requirement, by the way?
Yes, to not take
corporate money. No corporate money. Yes. Are there any other, because I know groups like Justice Democrats have a couple of stipulations.
Yeah.
So what are some of the requirements for people to sort of receive the endorsement of Matriarch?
So first requirement is you have to be nominated. And you go to the website. Right now, we're only taking congressional nominations. Hopefully, someday we can grow outwards, but you know, little by little. So you go to matriarchpac.com, and you can nominate someone who's running for Congress right now until December 1st.
And our audience can do that today if they want
today,
to.
Today, yes.
Okay.
And we've gotten, so many nominations.
I had read 1,500, but that was a while ago.
It's a little, you know, there's a lot of duplicates, a lot, which is amazing that there are women who are being nominated by dozens and dozens of people in their community. And it's encouraging, and we pay attention to that. Then we send out a questionnaire, and the questionnaire is basically our progressive platform. You know, we stipulation definitely, corporate money is a no-no. Would you support the Green New Deal? Would you fight for criminal justice reform? Would you fight for restorative justice? Would you, are you Medicare for all? It's the mainline progressive platform. But, you know, one thing that we have to keep in mind here is we're also taking into consideration, do you have access to wealth? Are you independently wealthy? Mm-hmm. Because the factor that the establishment looks at when they're deciding, shocker, should I support this person, is can this person raise $250,000, $300,000 in a couple of months?
Yeah.
Because it's a return on investment for them. Mm-hmm. They want to make sure that their funds are not depleted, that their staff is paid for, that their consultants are paid. And we just don't think that's fair, because most working class people don't have access to that kind of wealth. The first thing that they tell you when you go to these trainings is go through your Rolodex and ask everybody for money.
Yeah.
Well, that might last like a couple days at most.
Yeah.
Even, you know, I ran for office, and you know, I've been in the industry for a while, and I couldn't do that. I had to go on shows like TYT. I had to go on shows, you know, like The Hill. Like, all these shows are giving a voice to progressives that they didn't have before, so that you can receive small dollar donations. And there aren't many PACs, there aren't many organizations out there that support that. We not only want to help financially, but we want to help with some of the legwork, the advisory roles. You know, for the press, candidates won't get press attention until they've raised a certain amount of money.
Yeah.
But you need that press attention to raise the money.
Yeah.
So we want to help fill that void and give these candidates a platform so that they can not only run and win, but if they don't win the first time, that's okay.
Yeah, they're still getting experience.
You know, not only are they getting experience, they're sharing a progressive platform in their communities that the Democratic Party has frankly ignored for 25 years. So it takes the average woman 3-4 times to run and win.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen overnight. But we have to think smarter about how we support candidates. We believe that these women are more electable. They know the issues that most Americans are facing. And of course, they have the courage when they go to Congress. So
If someone's watching and they want to either help support a particular candidate or support the group itself, what can they do?
So right now, we are combing through these nominations very quickly until December 1st. And then we will be unveiling our first slate of candidates. We're hoping to scale out as the primary cycle goes on. Every state has a different primary date, so we're probably going to be prioritizing people who have earlier primaries or need a little bit more help in the beginning than others. But go to matriarchpack.com and you can contribute there. The more money we raise, the more candidates we can help.
Yeah.
The more people we can have on our team who are there to assist candidates. Because it's not just about supporting the candidates financially, there's other stuff that they need. Mm-hmm. You know, not every campaign can hire a press team. Not every campaign can hire a policy advisor. It is really these organizations out there that help do a lot of that legwork, and we need to build that progressive ecosystem the way that the DCCC and other large groups do, you know, that take corporate money.
Yeah. Matriarchpack.com.
Matriarchpack.com.
Awesome. Nomi, it's great to have you out here.
Thank you so much.
Anytime you can come out, we'd love to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And for those of you at home, we're going to take a short break. We come back, Emma Vigeland of Rebel HQ is going to be joining us to break down some of the big news of the day after this. A video of presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg speaking at a candidates forum back in 2010 has resurfaced thanks to comments he made about the Tea Party, which was then in its early years. Listen to what Pete had to say.
I have to admit, as a Democrat, many of my friends and supporters looked at me as if I was absolutely nuts when I suggested that I would be coming tonight to speak with a group that's often identified with the Tea Party. There's some, especially in my party, that the Tea Party is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican Party. But there are many others who believe that the Tea Party is motivated by real concerns about the direction of our government and the responsiveness of our government to citizens, and above all, the frustration with business as usual. That is what motivated me to run. And so while we may come from often very different perspectives, I believe we might find...
So that is one way to describe what motivated the Tea Party initially. And joining us now to break down other potential explanations for the Tea Party's formation, from Rebel HQ, Emma Vigeland, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Great to have you here. So Pete Buttigieg, the Tea Party is just motivated by a concern about the direction of our government. You've been following the Tea Party over the past few years and everything. What do you think about that description of it?
Well, so I mean, obviously the Tea Party was initially born out of racism, and I think that characterizing it as anything different, it does a disservice to actually what happened. I mean, the birther movement was a huge part of the Tea Party whole debacle as well. There is a point to be made, though, that the Tea Party and now what we're seeing with Donald Trump is a movement that was born out of frustration with politics as usual, as Buttigieg says. But again, it's this frustrating both sidesism that neoliberals like to push forward, where he, you know, it's not like he's saying, well, so I'm going to run as a leftist populist because we need to end these corrupt systems. He's just saying, well, some people say this and others say this, and so I'm going to give this speech that says nothing at all, but I sound really smart. And that kind of epitomizes his candidacy and his political career as a whole.
Yeah, and really fast on the Tea Party, there's the idea that they were just frustrated with the direction of the government, which I don't think makes sense, because the Tea Party protests started like 2 months into Obama's presidency. Like, how much time had they had to determine that it was moving in the wrong direction? It was mighty fast that organized. There's the argument that it was issue-based, that it was about deficits and out-of-control government spending. Well, Trump has exploded the deficit and the national debt, and I haven't heard a peep out of anyone from the Tea Party, so I have a feeling that's not what it was. And on the race thing, I did a little bit of research, and really fast, I just want to run through two little graphics about some research that's been done about the racial origins of the Tea Party. In 5 separate studies, a group that was primed with racial threat-inducing stimuli showed significantly more support for the Tea Party than a similar group that didn't. So if you scare white people about racial stuff, they suddenly become more supportive of the Tea Party, the direction of the government. And then also, racial resentment stokes Tea Party fears about generational societal change and fuels the Tea Party's strong opposition to President Obama. Consistent with that conclusion, an April 2010 poll found that Tea Party supporters were nearly twice as likely as the general public to endorse the symbolic racist belief that too much has been made of the problems facing black people in recent years. That poll, by the way, was just a handful of months before the video that we showed you with Pete Buttigieg. And obviously, I mean, you've been following Buttigieg, who's exploded in the polls in Iowa, but I just saw in South Carolina, he was at 0% with black voters. So that certainly seems like an area where he's lagging behind.
Well, certainly. And I think it's a chicken or the egg conversation when we're talking about the Tea Party, because while I do hear what you're saying, and racial resentment is definitely going to be what polls the highest when it comes to motivating factors. Racial resentment and increase in it is often, I think, born of economic factors sometimes. Now, you know, it's stoked up more so when people are hurting. They feel more inclined to turn to racism than maybe in the past, and that will motivate them more to go to the polls than other things. So I hear what you're saying, but this is what Pete Buttigieg has been about and has always been about, where he wants to play both sides. He wants to appear as just the smartest guy in the room and appear as all things to all people, which is kind of the 1990s neoliberal playbook that we've been seeing time and time again, but it doesn't work anymore. Unfortunately, it seems like it is working in Iowa. The fact that he's leading in some polls is very concerning and goes to show that we as a progressive community have a lot of work to do. But again, Iowa's a caucus, so we can't always be sure. A reminder that Obama in 2008 was not polling as well in Iowa as obviously the result.
That's true.
He won Iowa, right? So I'm not misremembering.
I don't believe so. I think that you're right there. Yeah, it would potentially throws things off when you try to correlate the poll into the end result. But finally, I'll say this video is obviously from 9 years ago. It's incredibly likely that Pete Buttigieg has a different opinion of the Tea Party now. So to the Buttigieg campaign, feel free to come on the show and talk about the Tea Party and its legacy. I think that would be very helpful at this point. But moving on to other news, Chick-fil-A has been People have had an issue with it for a number of years because of its advocacy against the LGBT community, not only in, you know, the personal position of its owner, but also its donations to groups. Well, that has apparently changed, at least in part, with Chick-fil-A saying yesterday that it had stopped making charitable donations to the Salvation Army and the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, groups that have been widely criticized by advocates for the LGBT community. Equal rights advocates described Chick-fil-A's decision to stop funding the charities as a positive step, but called on the chain to do more. Emma, what do you think about this shift in position for Chick-fil-A?
Chick-fil-A is overrated. The chicken isn't even that good. What, go to Popeyes, go to KFC.
You're a Popeyes stan, is that what they say now?
I used to go to Popeyes in high school, and instead of the other side, I would say, give me a second biscuit. And the people at the register were like, you are a freak. What were we talking about?
I don't remember. Hold on, really fast on that, because you brought up Popeyes. I wasn't going to, but is it crazy to say that this might have been influenced by Popeyes?
Oh, I definitely think it was influenced by Popeyes. I mean, one, they want to get back in the news. Popeyes has been dominating the news with their amazing sandwich. And so, of course, Chick-fil-A needs to make some sort of PR stunt to get back in the news. And now they're saying, oh, we won't donate to these problematic groups going forward, but then also backtracking and saying, well, we might. So it was clearly a headline grab. And it really, like, in terms of their bottom line, it's only ideologically driven by the owner. It affects them zilch if they choose not to donate to anti-LGBTQ groups. So it's a way to get back in the news. And I think you're dead on there, even though it sounds ridiculous.
In terms of it affecting them, you might be wrong. We'll have to see, because the right was not happy about this. The right simultaneously thinks that if you have a problem with a chicken place discriminating against the LGBT community, you're a weirdo. But they think it's normal to be mad if a chicken place stops discriminating against that community. And as two examples, two totally intellectually honest non-grifters, Ben Shapiro said Chick-fil-A has survived and thrived because they served everyone and refused to cater to the cancel culture. Now they've caved at the behest of the censorious left. This is a terrible move and just the latest indicator that the center cannot hold. The center apparently being held up by chicken. And also, he appears to be saying that one of the reasons Chick-fil-A was successful was because they discriminated against the LGBT community, which is a weird take.
What happened to free markets, Ben? I thought you wanted the free market to decide. And now the free market is deciding. If our theory holds, John, the free market has said that the Popeyes chicken sandwich is really spooking Chick-fil-A. So they got to make this big. So they got to make this big stunt. And also, I love how Ben Shapiro pretends to be concerned about the center. You know, he's just like a Chris Saliza on what is going on there.
I don't remember why we made that, but there you go. We should have made a chicken, but
right, exactly.
Oh, really fast. Let me give you one more so I can get your commentary on another. So this is about having a little bit more respect for the rights of the LGBT community. So it's not like Dave Rubin was ever going to not chime in on the wrong side. So he said the decision makes absolutely no sense. Chick-fil-A was actually cool because it stood up to the progressive mind virus, which is cancel culture. So he thinks that Chick-fil-A was cool because it discriminated against the LGBT community. I don't think that makes something cool. I don't think it has anything to do with it, actually.
Yeah, I mean, Dave Rubin is gradually becoming, you know, a Candace Owens type figure in the sense that, like, yeah, he was always disingenuous and pretending to be a progressive, but now he's legitimately stoking homophobes on purpose. I mean, he tweeted this dog whistle about AOC, who was with an LGBTQ member in drag.
Yeah.
And basically making fun of them. And now he's doing the same thing here. So I hope that money is really worth it, because there is a market for Uncle Tom-esque, people of their own community to go on Fox News and go on conservative websites and basically say how their community is wrong. And Dave Rubin seems to be cornering that market. I hope he's proud.
Well, look, I'll just focus on if you're gonna say that you care about the free market and free speech, that really does go both ways. You can't be mad when, you know, an owner decides that it's better, his economic interests will be served by not discriminating at someone. Like, he says he's not calling for any sort of boycott or anything, but he is attacking the group because they're not attacking some other group. That seems bizarre. But anyway, go to Popeyes. It's really good. Except I haven't gone because the lines seem really long. Emma, are you ready to turn to the biggest story of the year?
I am. I'm shocked you didn't lead with this story in terms of importance, but go on.
Okay. Fartgate is here. What is it about? A fart, obviously. But who farted? Was it Chris Matthews? Was it Eric Swalwell? Let's take a look at the evidence.
The evidence is uncontradicted that the president used taxpayer dollars to ask the Ukrainians to help him cheat an election.
That sounds like we added it in post.
I know. It is not a mug. I don't believe it. That's a false flag mug.
Each time I listen to it, it gets louder somehow. Okay, so you referenced the mug. So look, let's go through the evidence. So Hardball tweeted out, because he was on with Chris Matthews, who is apparently, by the way, if you do more research on this than I'm prepared to do, has farted multiple times at a show before. But anyway, they tweeted, "Sorry to disappoint the conspiracy theorists. It was the Hardball mug scraping across the desk. Get yours today and let's get back to the news." No, don't get it, because it's gonna make people think that you're farting constantly. But anyway, Eric Swalwell responded to that by saying, "Total exoneration."
What do you think? That was pretty funny. I mean, he seemed to like smile slightly in the middle of it, or maybe he heard it. He said he did not hear it, but at the same time, he was kind of smiling throughout the segment, and I don't really understand why. Then he pauses.
So let's play it one more time, because he pauses oddly, and I think it was Sophie or Angel, I forget who, said that he goes up a little bit. Let's play it again and let's find out.
The evidence is uncontradicted that the president used taxpayer dollars to ask the Ukrainians to help him cheat an election.
What are you supposed to make of that? He definitely paused.
He was clenching, but it wasn't enough.
Now, okay, look, I want to do one final thing. You're not going to be able to see this, but you know what I've got in my hand? I've got a mug, and I'm going to scrape it. Didn't hear it. Look, no farts.
Do it quicker.
No, nothing.
Do it
quicker. It's silent, but I don't want to spill coffee. So look, we're joking. Maybe it was a mug. Maybe it was a microphone getting touched or something like that. If I was Eric Swalwell, I would probably want to get to the bottom of this, so to speak, because it does not look good for him at this point.
Right, his bottom of this.
I apologize to you, Emma, for using your time to talk about this story, but thank you for being a good sport.
No, it was so fun. Yeah. Thank you.
Emma, as always, people should go take a look at your work at Rebel HQ, and we always appreciate you joining the show.
Appreciate it, John. Thanks.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, lots more to get to. Very excited now for a fascinating discussion, I'm sure, with our guest Ramesh Srinivasan on his new book, Beyond the Valley.
What's up, John? How you doing?
I'm glad to have you in studio. We've done the main show before. You're, you know, an accomplished author, but we were just talking before this block, and you said this is the biggest book. Tell people about what can they expect out of Beyond the Valley.
Yeah, I mean, technology is increasingly defining our lives, right? I mean, every experience we have is digitally mediated in some manner or another.
Yeah.
Obviously politics, right? Obviously economically, right? But even when we decide to navigate with our car, or when we receive insurance, or when we interact with businesses, everything is digitally mediated. And in fact, even when we just sort of live our lives in a normal sense, you know, without actively using technology, we are constantly leaving digital footprints. Mm-hmm. So we are being tracked, and data is being collected about us 24/7, 365.
Yeah.
So that's the larger issue that's at play. The concern around it, as is commonly understood here on the Young Turks, is a few private corporations interested by definition in their only their self-interest, their expanded valuation, their expanded profitability have taken power over that reality.
Yeah.
So what that means is that disruption or that innovation is self-serving and it's zero sum. And as a result, we see massive threats to vulnerable people, to indigenous people, to working class people, to all of us as sort of citizens who believe in a progressive democracy, to women in certain cases, to workers of the future. So all of this is at stake. So the book is calling out what happens with the internet.
And it is a global scope in the book.
Global
scope. It's not just about the United States.
That's right.
Although that's where my knowledge ends, is on the borders. I'm kidding. But so you sort of made this clear, but just to be clear for people who might not really have thought about, as you say, the digital like fingerprints and footprints that they're leaving behind.
Yeah.
Almost all of these corporations that control all the data, Google and Facebook, they have made from the beginning in many cases huge promises that they respect your rights, that they're going to protect your digital data. At this point, it seems pretty clear that they had no interest in that, or at the very least, they couldn't sustain it, right?
Yeah, I mean, making statements like we protect your data, or have you really analyzed it in the practices of these companies are basically platitudes, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we'll protect your data, but we're gonna use your data to behaviorally manipulate you if it suits our business model and our advertisers, who could be shady parties like the Russian government or Cambridge Analytica or like, you know, super sketchy right-wing conspiracy like businesses like the Mercers ran and Steve Bannon has been a professional in. So it's really like sell to the highest bidder in a sense. And it's not just these companies, it's also like data brokers, right? Like I could purchase all of your credit card records, Sean. I could have I could do that right away, and that's what Cambridge Analytica did. So the issue is this kind of
I lend my credit card to a lot of people, by the way, so some of that's not mine.
Okay, there you
anyway,
go.
Anyway,
good comeback.
So that's a great point. I didn't even know that, and I'm sure most people don't. You listed a lot of different groups that are either in effect compromised or at least hypothetically compromised. What are some examples of the way that this access that these corporations have has been used against different groups?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's on the one hand, you know, this is obviously deeply troubling when it comes to concerns around individual privacy, which is something we can get a lot of people around, including libertarians who, you know, the book is written as a progressive book, not necessarily a libertarian book. However, at scale, what happens is really disastrous. I'll give you several examples. Every facial recognition system across the board, whether they're American facial recognition systems or Chinese facial recognition systems, across the board, misidentify women like Michelle Obama, Oprah, Serena Williams. They misidentify them as men. When you used to search on Google for gorillas image recognition, you get pictures of black people. So what's happening here is that the people who are building these technologies are building them based on their biases, not because they're intentionally racist, but they have a certain way of sorting out and coding information. These systems are learning from the data sets in our world, generally learning from white male kinds of ways of looking at the world, somewhat Asian male as well, and they're reinforcing these biases. They're discriminatory. So if you see that same logic implement itself in courtroom systems that are using AI, kind of like Minority Report type stuff, or predictive policing systems, you can see how people who have not even committed felonies in the past are judged as at higher risk and are given higher sentences based on predictions that are based upon inequality.
Yeah.
Another example, Amazon has been selling facial recognition software to ICE. So don't look past the hype of the whole, like, you know, soap opera spat of Bezos and Trump. That's all BS. Actually, look
when it comes
at the business.
To the money, they're
it's all the business models are deep, right? And they're selling that technology to ICE. ICE is going into neighborhoods, I would say illegally, rounding up people and misidentifying people who are documented as undocumented, right?
Yeah.
So even if you believed in ICE,
tie it together, its rate of misidentification is far higher for certain demographic groups and racial groups than for others. It's better at telling one white person from another than it is, I'm not speaking specifically with the Amazon ones, but I've done stories recently about these police systems that think that black people look alike because it's been programmed without the ability to really tell them apart.
That's right.
So basically everything you're saying here in one way or another undercuts many of the stories that we talk about on a daily basis on the show.
Precisely. It's the asymmetries of our world as it is, a deeply unequal country and world that, you know, you call out better than anyone in the Young Turks. embedding themselves into technologies that people think of as convenient, efficient, consumer facing, you know, normal, whatever. So the hood behind it, the engine that is actually reinforcing and amplifying these inequalities, is the technological asymmetries themselves.
Yeah.
And give you another killer example. Think about the gig economy. Think about automation, right? Mm-hmm. So many people's jobs are going to be taken away, between 35 and 50% based on where you look, right? The gig economy we're seeing is giving people the inability to unionize, that we're trying to change that. Non-living wages, non-benefits, increasing these inequalities. These are ways of using technology to make work and workers more precarious, right? And so all this automation, these jobs are going to be taken away for working and middle class people by technologies that are owned and introduced by private corporations. Just go into like an Amazon fulfillment center. It's a hard thing to do.
I actually would like to.
It's like Robotville,
right?
And the people that are there have wristbands on their, and they're not like Happy Fitbits, which was bought by Google. The wristbands that are tracking their productivity.
Yeah.
So we are building automated systems in the image of the powerful, in the image of the elite, in the image of the most heinous forms of top-down macro capitalism.
Yeah.
So that's why we need to develop justice and equity. And I give examples of how that could look like from all over the world, including in our country. Mm-hmm. And I've been pushing out all these op-eds, you know, New York Times I'm working on right now, did a piece for Wired, did a piece for the Washington Post. I'm just trying to push this message out so we can ensure and restore balance. And so that's why I support, you know, Senator Sanders, as you know, and because he's interested in restoring balance, in supporting workers, in supporting like people's interests.
Yeah.
And I want to fight for technology that supports those aims as well.
I wish that we had more time. Really fast, though, I just want to make clear for people that, as you alluded to right there, this is both diagnosing the problem in many aspects, but also providing potential solutions.
That's right.
And you're saying it's like some of this seems super technical, but it's written for regular people to digest and understand.
Anybody and everybody. It's full of stories. And a lot of the solutions I provide are ones where, you know, workers have greater equity over digital organizations, that people are potentially paid and compensated based on their data, though I have some issues with that, where every sort of system that is influencing the public is designed and audited by the public, where there's total disclosure from tech companies about what they know about us, and that we own our data. We get to take our data away from them if we choose to.
Yeah.
So this is an inversion of power that can still achieve the incredible achievements of the internet, efficiency oriented, but not at the cost of all the rest of us.
And definitely sounds like the sooner we get to that, the better.
That's my aim, man.
Yeah.
That's my goal.
Awesome. Well, the book is Beyond the Valley. Ramesh, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it was great, John. Thank you for having me.
It was a lot of fun. I wish we had more time. We are gonna have to take a short break with just a little tiny story to close out the hour after this. Although you wouldn't know it from watching most of the news, protests are going on right now in Iran that have already proved deadly. Protesters took to the streets shortly after the government announced an increase in fuel prices by as much as 300%, depending on what area you're in. But although that was one of the initial impetuses, it has spread beyond that. There's longstanding economic grievances going back quite a while. And the issue is that the ruling regime has struck back with horrific violence in some cases. Depending on who you talk to, some official sources are saying 12 people have already died. But Amnesty International, citing credible reports, says it believes at least 106 people have been killed during these protests already. That was from allegations from a report released Tuesday. But as it stands right now, in addition to the violence, there's also been a significant crackdown on the ability to organize and communicate for those participating in these protests. The Iranian government has shut down nearly all internet access in the country. There are pockets of access that have let people show what's happening on the ground, but they're rare. Phone calls abroad still work, but those are closely monitored. And while this is going on right now in Iran, it is not just in Iran that governments are starting to wield this sort of power over the internet more broadly. Both India and Pakistan have shut down internet access in the hotly disputed territory of Kashmir in recent months, while Russia recently gave itself the power to shut down the internet at will. And so as of right now, it's not using that power, but hypothetically, if protests against Putin or the government developed once again, as they have in multiple cases over the past few years, they could exercise that too. Now, in terms of what the government might do in the near future, their communications about this issue are not positive, with Khamenei saying, the counter-revolution and Iran's enemies have always supported sabotage and breaches of security and continue to do so. Unfortunately, some problems were caused. A number of people lost their lives and some centers were destroyed. So acknowledging the loss of life, but claiming that the people who have justifiable economic grievances are counter-revolutionaries is not what you want to hear. And in addition, the interior minister has warned that security forces will act against protesters if quote unquote vandalism continues. So when you already have at least 12, possibly more than 100 people who've been killed, the government's saying that, no, we're not backing down. If this continues, the violence will continue. That is literally the last thing that you want to hear. Unfortunately, with so much going on in the US, you're not hearing much about this story, but it is significant and ongoing, so don't ignore it. Okay, that's unfortunately all the time we have for the show today. Thank you so much for watching. A big packed show full of guests. Lots coming up throughout the rest of the week. Tomorrow, by the way, a huge testimony, Gordon Sondland. So join me and JR to break down that. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.